Dear listeners, Sai Ram from Prashanthi Nilayam and welcome once again to Vahini Satsang. Walking on this stream of Bhagwan's Vahini, soaking in this beauty of his message, we are now in chapter 9 of Sandeha Nivarini. And like we have done with every session, we have taken every chapter of Sandeha Nivarini and we have split it into various segments and we have prayed to Bhagwan to enlighten us on the nuances of his message that he himself has written. And Sandeha Nivarini, as many of you know, is a dialogue between the devotee and Bhagwan. In the previous session, and in fact in the last 2-3 sessions, we have been discussing segment 9.2. This is the second segment of chapter 9. Chapter 9 began with the idea of karma, where Bhagwan was emphasizing on how it is very important for everyone to be engaged in action and how the Lord himself is always engaged in so many activities, even though there is nothing in these three worlds that makes it obligatory for him to work. And Bhagwan emphasized on the importance of action. How it is imperative for not only men, but women and every being in creation to be engaged in ceaseless activity. And Bhagwan went on to clarify that in fact in this creation there is no one who is masculine. It is only the divine. There is only one Purusha. Everything is Prakriti. Everybody and everything is feminine. And even as we were discussing this aspect, the discussion moved on to destiny. If everything is decided by what is already written in our fate, what is the meaning of our action? And there Bhagwan went on to clarify, if you do not act, then whatever is destined for you also will slip away. And Bhagwan went on to share about the nature of the world, how the world is mithya. It is neither satya nor asatya. It is neither real nor unreal. And then Bhagwan enlightens us on the Purusha. Who is this Purusha? What is his nature? In fact, this is the last part of segment 9.2. Today we'll spend some time contemplating on this aspect, how Bhagwan has enumerated on the characteristics of the Supreme Purusha and what this means to us. What is it that we should imbibe from this and translate into our daily thinking, daily living, daily practice of his message? So let's listen once again to segment 9.2 and then we will continue the discussion from where we left off in the previous session.
So Swami, We should not sit with folded hands placing all burdens on destiny, isn't it?
What is important is you should act according to your capacity and leave the result of the action to destiny. It is wrong to desist from the appropriate karma, placing reliance on destiny. If you do so, even destiny will slip out of your hands. Whoever he be, he must engage himself in karma.
Yes, yes, Swami. In the Gita also, Krishna tells Arjuna, even I do karma. The universe cannot go on if I desist from karma. And so, if you withdraw from it, how can you realize the results of your karma? Karma is Purusha Lakshana, the hallmark of men.
You are silly. Is there a different hallmark for women? Karma is Prakriti Lakshana. All beings, men or women, trees or animals, worms, insects and so on, have to do karma. Everything in the universe is bound by this law. Everything that we experience, be it favorable or unfavorable, is its result. Therefore, karma is the characteristic of Prakriti. Do not refer to it as Purusha Lakshana. Paramatma is the one and only Purusha. Prakriti is all Shakti, feminine. You are all not Purushas, remember.
But Swami, there is distinction between men and women in nature, and also in their actions and experiences. One cannot help but accept this difference. In this scenario, how can we say that all are feminine?
My boy, you may imagine it to be so, guided by your natural reason. But the reality is not that. All this is just secular experience. It is superficial and far from the fundamental truth. This is simply play acting, mere impersonation. In some plays, men take the role of women. Sometimes women enact the role of men in plays. Are they therefore men? All these are roles assumed for the drama of life. However, since Prakriti is completely suffused with femininity, all the actors, no matter what role they play, are feminine, not masculine. The genuine Purusha is only one, that is Shiva, the Atma. The Atma is immanent in everyone, but for this reason alone, all cannot be deemed masculine. The Prakriti theater is like a girl's school, where all the roles of the play are taken up by girls. Shakti, which is feminine, puts on all these parts. But do not take the drama as real, my dear fellow.
Swami, even after hearing all this, the nature of the world remains an enigma to me. When one side is seen, it strikes me as real. When the other side is presented, it strikes me as unreal. Nothing is definite.
That is exactly the nature of mithya. It means that the world is mithya. It is neither satya nor asatya. It is neither real nor unreal. You are born in mithya. You are enmeshed in it. And so you cannot distinguish this from that, the satya from the asatya.
Then, setting aside this discussion of mithya, tell me, Swami, about that satya, that Purusha, whoever he is.
The Purusha has neither birth nor death. He undergoes no change. He is Chit Swarupa and Jnana Swarupa. He is wisdom. Dharma or codes of social conduct are not of his nature. So he is not Dharma Swarupa. The Jnana, which is his nature, does not change, is not corrected or supplemented from time to time. It is eternal wisdom. Light is its nature, and so it does not admit a dot of darkness. The sun does not have effulgence added to it from the world it illumines. It will emit splendor whether there are worlds or not. Similarly, the innate nature never changes. The Purusha is self-luminous. He is always the object of knowledge. He cognizes all vrittis or mutations of the chitta or consciousness. The chitta is parinami, it changes and evolves, but the Purusha is modificationless, aparinami, unevolved. The Purusha is wisdom itself which never changes. No vyapara or activity can affect him. Even when unmanifested, effulgence is his nature. The seed in the soil is the unmanifested form of the tree. The tree is the manifested form of the seed. This change from the seed to tree and tree to seed shows that activity of the Shakti in the seed. This is Parinama. But the Purusha is unchanging, unaffected. He is the seer. He is completely apart from Prakriti. No deed can diminish his glory nor exhaust his personality.
So that is how segment 9.2 concludes. There is much more to do, much more in this chapter. There's another segment, 9.3 in chapter 9, but just reflecting on what Bhagavan says in the last part of segment 9.2, Swami says the Purusha has neither birth nor death. He undergoes no change. He is wisdom. Wisdom is his nature. It is eternal wisdom. I am reminded of 1974. It was Vrindavan. Dr. Bhagwantam, who used to translate Bhagwan's discourses, Mr. Ramabrahmam, the caretaker of the Vrindavan ashram, and a few boys were around Bhagwan. And Swami suddenly asked, "Do you know the most appropriate way of addressing me?" And the boys and the different guests who were there, the elders, came up with many answers. "Swami, we should address you as Bhagwan." Someone said, "As Sai Mata. As Sai Deva." "No, Swami, we should address you as Devadi Deva." Someone said, "No, Swami, we should just address you as Swami, Bhagwan." Heard all the answers patiently. And then Swami asked Dr. Bhagwantam, "Do you recollect the way in which the Raja of Venkatagiri used to call me?" Apparently the Raja of Venkatagiri had a very unique way of addressing Bhagwan. Dr. Bhagwantam could not immediately recollect. And Swami then smiled and said, "He used to always call me as my dear Atman. Whenever he had to address me, he would say, 'My dear Atman.'" And then Bhagwan said, "This is the correct way to address me, my dear Atman. This is the fundamental truth that you should know about me." These are revelatory moments, moments of deep reflection, introspection, moments of inquiry, which will lead us to the door of wisdom within. As Bhagwan used to always say, if you know yourself, then obviously, automatically, you will know me. So what is this, my dear Atman, that Bhagwan said is the best way to address him? The word Atma is often used with various prefixes, and that's how you have the words Jivatma, Mahatma, or Duratma. And of course, you have the word Paramatma. So what is the difference between Jivatma, Mahatma, Atma? Let's consider a person sailing from, say, Hawaii to the West Indies, and he is coming by the western route, so to speak. So he goes first through the Pacific, then through the Indian Ocean, past Sri Lanka and South Africa, and finally via the Atlantic, he reaches his destination. And if you see, it is one continuous waterway from start to finish. Even though it is one continuous body of water, yet there are different names which are given to different stretches of water. Pacific Ocean, Indian Ocean, Atlantic Ocean. Let's take another example. There is an empty pot placed on the ground with its mouth facing the sky. There is space inside the pot as well as above it. In fact, the space that is there above the pot stretches all the way to the end of the sky, to the end of the universe. Yet, one often talks of the space inside the pot as if that space is distinct from the space outside it. So if you see in both these illustrations, be it the one same body of water, or here one continuum of space, both are single and extended, but for convenience it is compartmentalized and identified as different segments. The water body is split into different oceans, and the space is treated as space inside the pot and space outside the pot. So depending on what our perspective is, one can look at this scenario and say everything is just one entity, or also think of it as distinct segments. Based on these analogies, if you think about the Atma, Paramatma or Brahman is like this wide expanse of water, or this space that pervades everywhere. That is Paramatma. Jivatma is a portion of it, just like the space inside the pot. Just as a portion of the body of water which is called Indian Ocean. In the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna tells Arjuna, the eternal Jivatma in the human body is but a part of my own being, and it is that alone which draws around itself the mind and the senses, both of which are rooted in Prakriti. Chapter 15 of Bhagavad Gita. A question that immediately arises in this context is, just as space is trapped to some extent by a pot, what is it that, so to speak, partially traps the all-pervasive Atma? And the answer is, it is the subtle body which does this. And it is this trapped portion of this infinite Atma, which is often referred to as the Jivatma, just like the space inside the pot. Qualitatively, there is no difference between the Jivatma and the Paramatma, just like the space inside the pot and outside the pot is same. But the difference is that the Jivatma is embodied or sort of trapped in the subtle body. If Paramatma is a witness, as Krishna tells Arjuna in the Bhagavad Gita, then Jivatma also is. The only difference is the Paramatma is a witness to the entire universe, whereas Jivatma is a witness to the experiences of the body in which it is located. Bhagwan, in another discourse, mentions, who is a Jiva? Jiva is God. The Jiva resides in a body. The Jivatma and the Divine Principle, the Paramatma, are not two distinct and separate entities, Bhagwan emphatically states. Just like the pot, the space inside the pot and space outside the pot are not distinct entities. So what does this Jiva do residing in the body? And the answer is, the Jiva acts merely as a witness, because it is just a witness, apart from, of course, supplying energy. The Jivatma is of the same nature as the Paramatma. The Paramatma is the ultimate source of cosmic energy which animates the entire universe. But as far as the body is concerned, the vital forces which animate the body derive their energy from the Jivatma. So the vital forces which make the body alive, where do they get their energy from? They get their energy from the Jiva. Let's take an example. The example of a steam engine. The engine functions because of steam. But to produce steam, one needs fire. Thus fire, which is the primary source of energy, is the Jiva. That is the Jiva. The steam is like the vital force. Bhagwan used to often give the electrical analogy, and Swami would say the ultimate source of energy to all the bulbs is electricity. Bulbs are many, but the current is one, Swami would say. So if you look at in this light, the so-called vital forces, they exist and operate entirely on account of the Atma, the fire. Just as the fire in the steam engine produces heat and leaves all the rest to the steam and the mechanical machinery, so also the Jiva triggers the vital forces, which in turn make the body engage in action. Thus, like the fire in the steam engine, the Jiva is not directly involved, but the Jiva is the ultimate source of the energy, and the Jiva is a witness. So how does this Atma cum vital force combination actually operate in practice? Take for example the power of sight. We always think it is the eyes that see. But is it true? Is it the eyes that really see? No. The eye is inert. Who is it that sees? That seer is the Atma. Consider the ears. People are listening to a broadcast from their loudspeakers. They may consider the loudspeakers as the source of the sounds that they hear. But is that true? If there is no power, the loudspeakers will go silent, isn't it? The power, the current is the basic factor. The ears are like a loudspeaker, Swami used to say. It is because of the current of the Atma that the ears are able to hear. Hence, for the functioning of all the sense organs, the Atma is the basic. It is the Atma which illumines the eye. If it was I that was seeing, then a person who has lost his life, a corpse also should be able to see, isn't it? Because the eyes are still there, the ear is still there. How is it that the eyes are not able to see when a person becomes dead? So it is the Atma that powers, it is the fire in the steam engine. And it is not just the sense organs, but even the intellect. Everything is illumined by the Atma. The intellect is shining on account of the Atma. The ultimate source that illumines everything is the Atma. It is like the main switch. Bhagavan says, in the absence of atmic power, which enables all the organs or tools to function, the body becomes a worthless mass of flesh and bones. And Bhagavan continues, we need not carry a lamp to see a burning lamp, for the burning lamp can be seen by its own light, isn't it? When the self shines in all its splendor by its own light in everyone, we do not need any other light of knowledge to see the self. It is not possible to see the light of the Atma even by the light of the Buddhi, the intellect, because Buddhi itself derives its light from the self, from the Atma. Intellect is like the bulb. The self is like the electricity. It is the light of the Atma that shines through the senses and the organs of the body. Now if you go back to segment 9.2, Swami says, the Purusha is self-luminous. The Purusha is self-effulgent. The Purusha is aparinami. It is modificationless. The Chitta is parinami. It changes and evolves. But the Purusha is unevolved. The Purusha is wisdom itself, which never changes. No vyapara or activity can affect him. Even when unmanifested, effulgence is his nature, Bhagavan says. So it is this Purusha which is light itself, which is wisdom itself, and the Jivatma and the Paramatma, this Paramatma which is the Purusha, the Jivatma and the Paramatma are of the same nature, just like the space inside the pot and the space outside the pot. Both are witnesses. Both are the source of all energy. The gross body is easy to understand, being the biological entity consisting of various organs. The living being is basically the gross body plus subtle body plus Atma. The subtle body is a difficult concept to understand because we cannot see directly like the gross body. Because the subtle body, among other things, has the mind and the vital forces, the pancha pranas. And of course, the Atma is even more difficult to grasp because it is subtler than the subtle body. The subtle body derives its energy from this Atma, from the quote-unquote trapped Atma, the trapped portion of the Paramatma, trapped portion of that consciousness. And it is this source which energizes the body. So the soul is nothing but this Atma plus the subtle body combination. It is because the Atma gets caught up with the subtle body, one often refers to the portion of the Atma in the body as the embodied one. It is the same as the self or the Jiva. Let us take an interesting financial analogy. Suppose a person has $1,000 in a bank. Now the bank does not physically keep a bundle of currency notes worth a total of $1,000 in a particular place to indicate that there are $1,000 in the account. What happens is the deposit is only recorded merely as a number in some ledger or stored as an electronic signal in a computer. So in other words, the money is present in an intangible form, so to speak. Now suppose the person draws $100 from his account in the form of, say, $1 bills. The dollar bills represent money. And so does the entry in the account. The dollar bill, however, is of small denomination, whereas the money in the deposit is much more. The money in the account is inert, whereas the dollar bill can be directly used for cash transactions. So Bhagavan says that Jivatma is like this dollar bill. It's a small particle of the Paramatma. But unlike the bank account, which diminishes when a withdrawal is made, the Paramatma is infinite and Paramatma can never be depleted, inexhaustible. Just like the currency is suitable for cash dealings, the Jivatma is in a form suitable for contributing to the action in nature. And that's how we are able to do these actions. So in segment 9.2, Bhagavan is giving us a glimpse of the glory of this supreme principle, this Purusha, which has neither birth nor death, undergoes no change. He is Chit Swarupa, he is Gyan Swarupa. His innate never changes. The Purusha is self-luminous. No activity can affect him. Even when unmanifested, effulgence is his nature. It is the support of everything in the universe. In fact, I remember in 2004, Bhagavan had a fall physically, and Swami would give darshan in a golf cart. On one of those mornings, he emerged quite early for darshan, and not many devotees were seated in the mandir veranda. During those days, Bhagavan would stop at a particular point below the stage and with a little support climb the three steps leading to the portico. That day too, Bhagavan stopped at the usual spot. And seated at that point was a senior devotee who had seen Bhagavan at close quarters for nearly four decades. So as Bhagavan stepped out of the golf cart, Swami looked at this senior devotee and Swami asked, "Padana," meaning, "Did I fall down?" And the devotee could not understand what Bhagavan was referring to. I mean, he was so bewildered with that abrupt question. He actually started wondering if Swami is speaking to him in the first place or is speaking to someone else. And in fact, the elder who was accompanying Swami gestured to this person that Swami was actually speaking to him only. And Swami again looked at him and asked, "Padana, did I fall down?" And the question was an enigma of sorts to the devotee. He just could not think anything. But suddenly, by his grace, something occurred to him. And he thought Bhagavan was perhaps referring to what he had narrated in a public discourse a few months ago. Swami had mentioned about his fall in the washroom and so on. So as he was thinking about that episode, Bhagavan again now looked deep into his eyes and Swami asked, "Padana, did I fall down?" Now the devotee said, "Swami, if you fall, the whole world will come to a standstill, Swami." And the moment Bhagavan heard this, Swami nodded and Swami said, correct answer, correct answer. And then Bhagwan asked for the devotee's hand. Swami held his hand and alighted and started walking from the golf cart. The devotee says, for me it was such an unforgettable moment. This moment always reminds me of what he truly is. Can the source and support of the universe ever fall or falter? The only thing that falls and falters is our faith, isn't it? In fact, the one whose faith never shakes ever enjoys divine grace forever. And Swami is referring to this source and support of the universe. The Purusha, who is unchanging, unaffected. He is the seer. He is completely apart from Prakriti. No deed can diminish his glory nor exhaust his personality, Swami says. Once there was an interesting dialogue between a very well-known jnani of our times, a god man, and his disciple about Bhagwan. So one of the disciples of Sri Nisargadatta Maharaj was a frequent visitor to Prashantinilayam, and he became an ardent devotee of Bhagwan in course of time. So one evening while serving his guru, Nisargadatta Maharaji, who lived at Ketwadi in Mumbai, this person asked Sri Nisargadatta Maharaji, Maharaj, who is Sri Satya Sai Baba? And instead of answering the question of the curious disciple, Nisargadatta ji asked this devotee, you tell me, what does Baba say about himself? Now this disciple, who did not expect that question from his guru, said whatever he could remember at that time, and he said, Maharaji, Baba has revealed that he is the reincarnation of Sai Baba of Shirdi. Then Nisargadatta ji asked this devotee, when did Shirdi Sai Baba shed his mortal coil? He said, 1918. When did Sri Satya Sai Baba make his advent? He said, 1926. Then Sri Nisargadatta Maharaji said, Baba is what he was between 1918 and 1926. Baba is what he was between 1918 and 1926. Now this disciple could not really comprehend what Nisargadatta ji meant by that. So he pleaded with his guru, please, I cannot understand what you mean by this. Maharaji, please explain. Then Nisargadatta ji says, Sri Satya Sai Baba is Paripurna Parabrahman. He is Paripurna Parabrahman, the supreme absolute principle of the universe. So the disciple was so happy to listen to this from Nisargadatta ji. But Nisargadatta ji was not satisfied. He wanted to teach his disciple a higher lesson. So he asked the disciple, so what do you understand now about Baba? Now that I have told you this, what do you understand? So the disciple was baffled. He didn't know what to say. Then Nisargadatta ji said, idle curiosity and vain words are of no use to an aspirant. Try to know yourself. When you realize who you are, you will realize who Sri Satya Sai Baba is. And I think this is something that Bhagwan has often mentioned in his discourses. Unless we make that inquiry within, we will never ever get a glimpse of who he is. The more we discover about ourselves, the more we go deeper from the gross to the subtle, we will be on that journey to be in the vicinity of the Atma, because the Atma is even subtler than the subtle body. And we have to use the same tools of the mind, the intellect. Using the mind, we should go above the mind. During the 2005 convocation drama, Swami made many visits to the practice sessions and took personal interest in the play, the story, the makeup, the music and so on. One boy who was very lucky to be part of the drama that year was playing the role of a director in a construction company where the chief architect resigns just before the launch of a key project. And there was a scene where this boy had to exhibit considerable anger on his resignation. So during one of the rehearsal sessions, Bhagwan was present, and this boy who had to be angry as part of that role somehow underplayed that anger, underplayed that scene, because he didn't feel very comfortable being loud and vocal before Bhagwan, because Swami was physically there. Even though it was a drama, but still he felt, how can I be this angry? So when they returned to Mandir after the practice session, Swami immediately called this boy. And Swami said, you should show more commitment to your role. And then Swami asked him, what was his role in the drama? Swami asked this boy what he thinks is Bhagwan's role in the drama. And the boy instantaneously said, Swami, you are the divine director. You are the divine director not only of this drama, but the drama of the entire universe. And then Swami said, Kadu Bangaru, Nenu director Kadu, Nenu script rachayita. I am not the director, I am the script writer. He is the script writer. He is the one who has it all. He has scripted for everyone. He is the director, he is the protagonist, and all the artists are there in his universal play. Swami says, I have written it all. All I need from you is commitment to your roles. Whatever role has been given, assigned to you, you have to do that well. If you have any clarifications on your roles, if you want clarity, you can ask me. But once you have got that role, you have to be committed and you have to do that to the best of your ability. He is that ultimate principle. And all we have to do is just play our role in a manner that makes the scriptwriter happy. In an interview, one boy asked Swami, Swami, how can we make best use of the avatar? And Bhagwan looked deep into this boy's eyes. Swami was distributing vibhuti. Swami stuffed a handful packets of vibhuti into this boy's palm, and Swami said, love. God is love. Live in love. That is the way to make best use of the avatar. In fact, during a conversation with MBA students, Bhagwan explained the triangle of what true love means. Swami said, love has three corners, like in a triangle. First, love is fearless. And it is because love is fearless that you would see Bhagwan correcting anyone. He is not apprehensive of how we will feel when he corrects us, because he wants us to improve And that is happening only because of his unconditional love towards us, unconditional love for our welfare, immense concern that we become better. If we move to a space where we have less sorrows and more joy and more lasting happiness. So that is the first quality of true love. The second quality of true love is changeless. Just like Bhagwan's love, it never changes. It never changes. It may seem for us sometimes, but Swami's love for us never ever changes. In fact, if anything, as we think of him more, we realize more about how immense, the immensity of the love we realize as times go by, as time goes by. But actually, it has been there in profusion always. It is our whole effort of discovering it more and more as the days go by. True love is fearless, true love is changeless, and true love is selfless. Unconditional giving. And that is what we have seen of Bhagwan's love. And that is the love of the Purusha. The Purusha does not need to act, but the Purusha is always engaged in action, and this is the action that the Purusha is always busy in. Unconditional giving. Loving selflessly, fearlessly, changelessly. Aham plus Akar. Swami says, Aham is I. When we give a form to that I, it means that it is getting attached to the body. That's when it becomes ego. Ego stems from attachment to the body. But if there is no attachment to the body, no akar, no form, it is only aham, then it is just love. In fact, in a very beautiful discourse in Vrindavan, during the summer course in 1991, Swami said, the scriptures have declared that the one who possesses in full all the 16 potencies is Purushottama, the Supreme Person. Swami said, this term is applied to the avatars. Because the avatars utilize the 16 potencies only for the benefit of others. Whatever the avatars say or do is totally free from any taint of self-interest. In fact, Swami makes that emphatic statement. No avatar, whether in India or elsewhere, has ever used the five elements, the five senses, the five vital airs, the pancha pranas, or the mind for any selfish purpose. Even when they go about in daily life like other ordinary beings, in every one of their actions, they demonstrate its purity and unchanging truth. This is the nature of the Paramatma. This is the nature of the Purusha that Bhagwan talks about in this segment. 9.2, the Purusha, which has neither birth nor death and doesn't undergo any change. His wisdom, self-luminous, light is its nature, does not admit a dot of darkness because the Purusha is selfless. No chance of darkness. The Purusha is fearless. The Purusha is changeless. The Purusha is all the time giving. The sun does not have effulgence added to it from the world it illumines, Swami says. Just like the sun, self-illumined. The sun will emit splendor whether there are worlds or not. Whether there is a creation, the sun will always emit light. Swami says that is how the Purusha is. And that is why it is aparinami, it is unevolved. Bhagwan then says in this segment 9.2, the seed in the soil is the unmanifested form of the tree. The tree is the manifested form of the seed. And this change from seed to the tree and the tree to the seed shows that the activity of the Shakti in the seed, it is the nature, it is the prakriti which lead to all these manifestations. And this is what is called parinama. This is the change. It happens because of the shakti, the manifested form of the divine principle. But the Purusha is unchanging, unaffected. The Purusha is the seer, completely apart. Even though the Prakriti is powered by Purusha, but Purusha is apart from the Prakriti. And that's why no deed can diminish his glory, nor exhaust his personality, Bhagavan says. And this Purusha is nothing but divine love. Divine love that is pure, that is permanent, that is changeless. And it is this love that the saints and sages of yore long to make their treasure. Saint Namdev, he was a tailor by profession, but he spent all his time thinking of Lord Vithala. So much so that his wife had a lot of problems in managing the household. One day her neighbor asked her, "How do you manage your household?" And she wept and said, "My husband is perpetually immersed in the worship of the Lord. I have a lot of problems in even providing a simple meal to my children." That neighbor was very kind, so she gave her a philosopher's stone, a stone which converts any metal into gold. So Namdev's wife took this stone and converted a few articles into gold and sold them. And with this she was able to provide an excellent meal to her children. And when Namdev came to know of this, Namdev was surprised and she asked her, "How could you afford such a meal?" And when she revealed the truth, Namdev took that philosopher's stone and he flung it into the river. When the neighbor came to know of this, they accused Namdev of robbery and greed. Many people gathered around his house. That neighbor was shouting at the top of his voice. Then Namdev said, If that philosopher's stone is all that important to you, okay, then wait. And Namdev just jumped into the river and brought out a heap of stones and said, "See, if your philosopher's stone is there among them." And to their utter amazement of everyone who was present, every stone that Namdev had picked up from the river had become a philosopher's stone. Everything had that power of Paras. When we have in possession God's wealth, when we are in tune with God's energy, when we can focus on this Paramatma, whose power and glory is inexhaustible, then there is nothing that we will ever lack in this world. And it should be our eternal striving to connect to this supreme principle. Bhagavan goes further in this segment, in this chapter 9. Bhagavan starts this chapter by saying we should be eternally engaged in action. And what should be the direction of our action? And how we should be steadfast in this principle, in this endeavor? Bhagavan goes further. And we'll come to that in the coming episode of Sandhya Nivarini. We will move on to segment 9.3 in the next session of Vahini Satsang. The last few sessions we were in segment 9.2, and 9.2 ends with Bhagavan enumerating, describing to us the glory of the Purusha. Contemplating on this, we will move to the last part of chapter 9 in the coming episode of Vahini Satsang. Dear listeners, as always, feel free to get in touch with us. If you have any thoughts, any insights, any comments, any suggestions, as always, you can write to listener@radiosai.org. You can also send us your comments on our WhatsApp number 9393-258-258. Offering this little endeavor at His lotus feet with immense gratitude and humility, I take your leave. Thank you so much. Sairam.